Today on The Horse Race, we bring you a roundup of all things State House, and later on in the show, the governor's race is drawing more potential candidates, and the down-ballot contests are seeing some shakeups as well. It's Thursday, December 9th.
Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I am Jennifer Smith, here with Lisa Kaczynski, and, there's only a few things certain in life: death, taxes, and probably that Lisa's tired because of press conferences and news. Is that correct this week?
It is correct this week. You have hit it right out of the park, as usual. This was supposed to be the quiet season, you know, the holidays, cute holiday things, snow, flakes, lights, gifts, happiness. And instead, here we are, without a governor running for re-election and an entire field in shambles with candidates who still can't get oxygen, who have been in the race for months, and a whole bunch of other candidates that I now have to wait until 2 a.m. every night to see if they're running, and check again at 6 a.m. if they're running, and just to make sure that Playbook is the most up-to-date for all of my lovely readers.
I was going to say, instead of, the soft sound of snowflakes falling, you have the harsh clacking of domino after domino falling all the way from the governor's office down to the local state legislature seats. The prosecutors aren't exempt from this. There's a ripple effect on that side as well. So, as usual, I am so sorry. Would it, make you jump out a window if I suggested that you still have state legislature budget season to look forward to?
Yes. Just stop now.
Oh, no. Okay. We're gonna go to a safe space. What are we doing here today? Do we know?
Yes, we are back with another installment of our State House Roundup with our friends of the pod, Katie Lannon and Shira Schoenberg. And later, I will bring you the scoop on all of those down-ballot dominoes and races that are taking shape, and the Senate vote on Rachel Rollins' nomination for U.S. Attorney from Massachusetts that's finally happening. Shall we get into it?
Let's head on over to the State House. Charlie Baker and Karen Polito's announcement that they will not be seeking re-election or election for governor and lieutenant governor reinvigorated the conversation around the governor's race, which, I don't know, had been dying down a little bit. But it also preceded a handful of announcements surrounding down-ballot races. Our very own Lisa Kaczynski has been following and covering the daily updates for the Politico Massachusetts Playbook, an essential morning read, FYI, here's a plug. So Lisa, we turn to you. What are the latest and greatest movements in the hashtag Mappily landscape?
So the first thing is that there's not movement in the governor's race. There are three candidates who have been running for governor on the Democratic side for at least half a year now, if not longer, depending on the candidate. Ben Downing, former state senator, I'm looking at you. And they're still plugging along. They're rolling out endorsements, policy proposals. And yet here we are with all of our eyes trained on State Attorney General Maura Healey, who we're still waiting a week after Governor Baker's announcement that he would not be seeking re-election, still waiting to see if she will be jumping into this governor's race. And which way she goes for 2022 might influence Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, who's weighing whether to return home and run for governor. But he's not likely to do so if Healey's in.
Okay, so that's the Democrats. Busy field already, could get busier. What about the Republicans right now?
So conservative former state rep Jeff Deal is still running for governor. He's backed by Donald Trump. But moderate Republicans, Baker allies, they are scrambling right now to find a successor to Baker, especially with Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito not running in his place. So far, we have Taunton Mayor Shauna O'Connell, who's considering it. She's a former state representative, so she has both legislative and executive experience. And then we also have former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling, who was a Trump appointee. But they're both to Baker's right, so it's not quite sure who's going to emerge yet on that side, and there could be some others for both governor and lieutenant governor on the Republican side, too.
So we talked about Ben Downing, who's running, but also, of course, one of the notable figures is State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, who is currently in the second Suffolk seat. And since she is running for governor, that means that her seat has been the focus of a potential down ballot race here. We had talked about State Reps Nika Elugardo and Liz Miranda, both as potentials, but likely one of them running would have meant that the other isn't. That has turned out not to be the case, right?
Turns out they're both in. State Representative Nika Elugardo, she had told me back in October that she would be seeking re-election to her House seat, essentially paving the way for her fellow state representative, Liz Miranda, to run for the state Senate seat being vacated by Sonia. But she changed course this week, and she's in. She's running for the Senate seat. She announced that on Monday night. And then Wednesday morning, we had the long-anticipated launch from Liz Miranda. So they're both running for the seat.
And so one thing that I'm glad you've spent so much time talking with both of them recently so we can delve into it a bit. One of the reasons that people were thinking one or the other of them would run is they're kind of coming from similar places politically. As we recall, they both kind of swept in during this progressive local wave of elections here in Boston. So let's start with Liz Miranda. Why does she say she wants to be in the race?
Yeah, they both come at this from similar backgrounds, and they both kind of have the same overarching angle, is that they both want to fight for the city's long underserved communities. I mean, this district cuts through the absolute heart of Boston's Black communities. Roxbury has picked up Mattapan now. So that's an overall theme for both of them, but they do come at this from different ways. So in Liz Miranda's case, you know, this is kind of her early pitch. She is a former youth worker, a community organizer, an entrepreneur, and those things have shaped her agenda in the House. She wants them to shape her agenda in the Senate. You know, she's been emphasizing her work on economic opportunity and health equity for years through various bills on the State House, and she wants to advance that work. And that's kind of the pitch that she is starting out with.
And what about Nika Elugardo?
Nika Elugardo comes from a slightly different district. So while Liz Miranda, her state rep district is, you know, kind of in the heart of Dorchester and Roxbury right now, Nika Elugardo's is more centered in Jamaica Plain. So she has more of a mix of people that she's representing right now. And she really sees herself as a bridge between some of the whiter communities that she represents now and Boston's BIPOC communities, and really bringing them together, advocating for everyone while also really lifting up the voices within, you know, the Black community, Latino communities, immigrant communities.
And is there anything we should know or be aware of to kind of frame this race here? There's been some rumors of other folks, specifically former reps, considering seeking the seat, but also, you know, half of the former elected officials in the city are just constantly in communication with each other, pushing each other to, you know, run for one seat or the other. So what's the context here that we should be aware of?
Open seats in Boston are, of course, rare. And this is a big opportunity, again, to represent the heart of Boston's Black communities. So you've seen interest from former State Senator Diane Wilkerson, who held this seat until she was unseated by Sonia Chang Diaz in a 2008 primary, and then, of course, was convicted of federal corruption charges and spent some time in prison. But she's reemerged as a prominent activist in the area, and she told the Dorchester Reporter that she is weighing whether to run again for her seat. State Representative Chyna Tyler, who's also in the district, she had been floated as a possibility, but she did tell me on Wednesday that she's very proud of the work on her redistricting committee, which she served on in strengthening the majority-minority aspect of this district, she's sticking with her House seat, at least for now.
Right. Well, if we, got here by talking about Sonia Chang Diaz, let's head right back on up to that first conversation. Maura Healey, if she were to get into the race for governor, would also leave open a pretty coveted statewide seat. That's being, you know, the Massachusetts Attorney General. Shannon Liss Reardon, who has been a guest on the podcast, a noted labor attorney, is considering a run for AG, but only if Healey's out. Is that right?
That is right. She formed a campaign committee this week so that she could start fundraising in the eventuality that Healey might not seek re-election. And then you have Quentin Palfrey, the former 2018 lieutenant governor nominee for the Dems. He's in the same boat. You know, he's thinking about it if Healey's out. And a third name that's kind of floating around is Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan.
Okay, well, if it's okay with you, Lisa, we can turn away from the governor's office for just a moment, because other people are running for seats.
There's an exciting development in Brookline this week. Raul Fernandez, who's the vice chair of the Brooklyn Select Board, is challenging State Rep Tommy Vitolo next year in the 15th Norfolk District. He launched his campaign this week. Vitolo had said that he would be running for re-election in an announcement last month. This race is going to be really interesting because Raul has a friend in Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They know each other from Boston University, where he's a lecturer. She came and campaigned for him when he was running for the Brooklyn Select Board in his first election a few years back. So she might be popping up in Massachusetts again to give him a hand.
Well, that is interesting, and we will keep an eye on that. But there is another election that is just around the corner, because next week there is the Democratic primary for a special election for the 1st Suffolk and Middlesex District Senate seat. And that, of course, has been vacated by Joe Boncori. Lisa, who's trying to fill that seat?
You have Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards and Revere School Committee member Anthony D'Ambrosio duking it out, quite literally, in this race. It's getting really testy. D'Ambrosio sent attack mailers against Lydia Edwards. Lydia Edwards has accused him of skipping a debate. It's really turning into quite the bitter battle.
And a lot of these quicker turnaround, especially special elections, very quickly turn into a very practical application of what actually matters here. Is it endorsements? Is it boots on the ground? Is it family connections? What is it in these kinds of hyper-local races? This race has a number of kind of conflicting elements here. So walk me through those conflicts.
All three of those things are definitely elements of this race. Endorsements have been flying. So Lydia Edwards has picked up Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, Attorney General Maura Healey, Representative Ayanna Pressley. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu came out just a couple days after she was sworn in as mayor to support Lydia Edwards, who have, of course, had supported her mayoral race. So she's really has the lock on Boston and, you know, the sliver of Cambridge that is in this district, at least right now, before redistricting next year. And Anthony D'Ambrosio is locking up everyone in Revere. And then you have Winthrop, which is just in the middle of this fight, seems to be splitting between the two candidates right now. I don't have a great sense of where, you know, that town as a whole is leaning, but you're definitely seeing it break down city versus city. You're seeing it break down ideologically with progressives largely backing Lydia Edwards and more kind of moderate to conservatives backing Anthony D'Ambrosio, which makes sense given, you know, where they're from and how this district splits. But this is really all going to come down to who these candidates can get to the polls in a special election during the holiday season and a primary to boot, which will actually pretty much decide who gets the seat because there is no Republican who made the ballot. So get out the vote efforts are going to be really key in this race.
And we will know how that shakes out next week. But until then, Lisa Kaczynski, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of this very podcast right here, thanks for taking the time to run us through these races.
Always a pleasure.
Weeks after a Thanksgiving deadline, the Massachusetts House and Senate finally reached agreement on a bill to spend about $4 billion of federal ARPA funds and surplus state revenue. In the bill heading to Governor Baker are a number of different investments, many of which are focused on the state's recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. So here to explain just what those investments are and what it took to get this bill off the ground are two Statehouse watchdogs and friends of the pod, Katie Lannon, reporter for the Statehouse News Service and president of the Massachusetts Statehouse Press Association. Hello.
Hey, Jen.
And Shira Schoenberg, reporter for Commonwealth Magazine. Hello as well.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Welcome back to both of you. Katie, why don't you start us off here, but Shira, feel free to jump in. What are the spending priorities that are kind of the top level highlights of the bill that came out of the House and Senate?
So some of the biggest single investments are things that didn't come as a surprise because we heard about this before we heard anything else about the bill. And that's $500 million towards the Unemployment Trust Fund, and another $500 million towards payments that will be kind of bonuses for low-income essential workers who stayed on the job during the state of emergency. Those, I think, are due to be made by March. And then there's really, I mean, if you can name it, it's in there. There's a lot of money in there that goes towards various healthcare needs, from behavioral health to public health, local public health systems, to home services, to payments to financially struggling hospitals in towns that were hard hit by COVID. There's environmental and water and sewer infrastructure, and there's a lot of money in there for different types of housing programs. Those are some of the kind of marquee programs. There's also a lot towards workforce development and things of that nature.
Shira, anything in there that either you particularly want to highlight, or has there been something else that you've been watching closely?
Yeah, I mean, I think Katie is right about the big buckets. I think because lawmakers had so much money to play with, they were actually in the really enviable position that they were able to fund the top priorities of both bodies. So in the Senate, for example, they put, I think, $400 million into behavioral health, including this massive loan repayment program for mental health clinicians. So that got in the final bill. And then on the House side, they put in, for example, a lot of money toward education. You know, they had $100 million in there to fix K-12 HVAC systems. The Senate didn't include any education spending in their version, but in the final bill, the House got a huge sum, I think of something like $200 million in education spending. So I think they were able to really use that money to fund things that were priorities of both sides, you know, the housing, the environmental infrastructure, physical infrastructure, but also to really pull out the priorities that both bodies had and to throw in another $200 million or so of earmarks.
So you mentioned, of course, the extremely large amount of money they had to pull from here, and it wasn't just ARPA money. So how did the math on this end up shaking out?
So I think at the bottom line, they ended up using about $2.5 billion of ARPA money and about $1.5 billion of surplus. That leaves close to half the ARPA money, about $2.3 billion in ARPA money left for future years. And Congress has said it has to be appropriated by 2024 and spent in 2026, by 2026. So now they have that large chunk of money to spend once they see what other federal money has come into the state and where, after this money has spent, there are more investments that still need to be made.
So did differences in the Senate and House priorities play a role in any of the delays? Notably, Charlie Baker was not happy with the kind of time frame it took to actually get this compromised bill over to him. So, Katie, what was with the delays, and was there anything that needed serious reconciling between the two chambers?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, and I'll never miss an opportunity to point this out, is part of the way the conference committee process works is we don't really know what the delays were. We don't know how the negotiations went. They're pretty much viewed, conference committee negotiations are viewed by lawmakers as a black box, and they're pretty tight-lipped about what they'll tell you. We do know that the bottom lines of the two bills were very similar initially, and it's the way they allocated the spending that was different. It seems very similar to me to how we see budget negotiations play out, where sometimes it's almost harder where you have a big pool of money than if you're really constrained on how much you can spend. There were a lot of earmarks made by both branches, so I think part of it was figuring out what local projects they could get in there and in what ways, and what would need to be done to get as many people on board as possible, including once they did miss that, you know, November 17th target date. The only way this bill was going to pass in the remaining weeks of, you know, calendar year 2021 was if they could get it through unanimously. So they had to find a way to maintain the unanimous support they had had.
So let's get into what some of these actual spending areas looked like. Shira, you noted in your write-up that there's $75 million allocated to small business relief, and then additionally beyond that, the Massachusetts Cultural Council will receive around $135 million in funding. So practically speaking, what does that mean for small business owners and arts sector space?
So the arts sector is actually really interesting because the line item for that was attributed to arts and culture was $135 million. When you really dig into it, you find out that there was about $60 million to the Cultural Council itself and the whole rest of it was earmarks. So money for all kinds of local arts and culture. And I think a few of the earmarks actually had nothing to do with arts and culture. We're just kind of thrown in there. But it's definitely a lot of money to revitalize a sector that's really been decimated in a year where nobody was going to the arts, no one was going to performances. Now they've obviously restarted again, but the audience is still more limited. A lot of gigs just weren't happening for such a long time. So they desperately need that money. In terms of small businesses, again, you have businesses that really were very decimated by the pandemic. They were forced to shut down. And again, now business is booming in a lot of ways. A lot of businesses did get federal loans to help them. I think a lot of this money is actually targeted specifically to minority-owned businesses and also businesses that are pretty new. So they were too new to be eligible for a number of those federal loans. So these are businesses that haven't really been able to benefit from some of the other support programs that are out there that should now get a fair amount of state money.
And one of the other pockets that was interesting to me was a number of different allocations for housing supports or housing investments or housing resources, you know, supportive housing. Whoever feels like they'd like to jump in on this one first, can you break down where the money is going for housing?
I can break down some of it. They kind of try to focus here on the different points along the housing spectrum, right? There's $115 million towards expanding home ownership opportunities for first-time buyers. So that's production of for sale below market rate housing. There's another $115 million for producing and preserving affordable rental housing, plus a bucket of $150 million for permanent supportive housing with the services included in it, and $150 million targeted for rehabilitating and modernizing state-aided public housing developments. So, you know, the housing piece has really been something that addresses a pre-pandemic issue. You know, we've certainly heard for a long time about, and I think everyone knows from their own experiences about the affordability of housing in Massachusetts. You know, we've heard about the limited stock and we know that what the prices are for it. And of course, the pandemic in a lot of ways has driven this home because you can't social distance if you don't have a place to go and have that space.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff Deal notably wants Baker to veto this bill over the unemployment insurance part of it. The bill right now has about $500 million for the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. If I recall correctly, the original ask from the governor's office was about $1 billion. Shira, can you break down where this dispute is actually centered and the likelihood that Baker would veto this bill for those reasons?
He's not going to veto the bill because of that. I will say this is a totally bizarre dispute right now because we have no idea what the status is of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Initially, there were numbers being thrown around that it was, owed something like $7 billion. The business owners were saying, well, we need at least $1 billion in there. And I think those are some of the numbers that Jeff Deal is talking about. The governor said, I believe he wanted to put $1 billion in. The Democrats in the legislature then decide to put in $500 million. And in that debate, it came out that actually there may be enough money in the fund to pay back this entire federal loan. And the Baker administration still hasn't put out a real accounting of how much money is actually in the fund, how much money needs to be paid out for various things. So we just don't know what the actual status of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is right now. So ideally, the Baker administration will actually put out something clarifying this. I think the governor has said repeatedly that money does need to go into this fund to help businesses, that even if there is money in there now, enough to pay back the federal loan, you do need some money to capitalize the fund going forward. But it's a little bit strange to be asking the governor to veto it in a state where we just don't know the actual situation of the fund.
And then looking at the bill kind of overall, how does this compare to initially what the governor was asking for? It's more money than we expected initially, but is it going to similar places?
So similar to how the House and the Senate had a lot of the same priority areas funded in this bill. This does have a lot of the same themes as the plan the governor put forward, but the amounts are different. For example, he had proposed $1 billion for housing and homeownership programs. This bill, I think, has about 600 million. So that's one major difference. You know, we've certainly heard from the governor on how much he wants to get going on housing production before. And, you know, I think he, in addition to wanting to get the money out more quickly than the legislature had an interest in doing because they wanted to go through that hearing process, he has wanted to spend more of it. And I think, you know, like Shira said, I don't expect him to necessarily veto this bill. It'll be interesting to see if there are things he does strike from the bill, things that he didn't agree with. You know, there's 163 pages in there, so there's certainly a lot happening in this bill.
And Shira, earlier you had noted, of course, there's still ARPA money left here that has kind of a clock going in terms of when it needs to be allocated and spent. So where right now are advocates, lawmakers looking for the next round of discussions about the rest of the money?
Every advocate wants more money for their project. Everyone wants the money. I think that initially there was some talk about, could we use this money for a particular transformative policy, you know, something like universal pre-kindergarten. And that didn't happen. What lawmakers really did was put a lot of money into largely pots where we've already been spending things on. You know, there are a few things that might be transformative, the mental health initiative, offshore wind or marine port development, but there was no, you know, one initiative. This is how we're going to completely overhaul the Commonwealth. So I think there might be some pressure to do something along those lines. I think advocates for things like some of the environmental infrastructure want to see what's going to come out of Congress in the federal infrastructure bill. You know, will there be enough money to handle things like the need for combined sewage overflow systems, basically to prevent sewage from flowing into the state rivers? People are looking there. I think obviously on the healthcare piece, hospitals are getting a lot of money. If hospitals are still struggling a year from now, 2 years from now, there'll be pressure to put more money there. I think a lot of this is just going to be about seeing what works and where the needs remain. I mean, if the idea is to get a lot of this money to minority communities, is it going to go there? And will those communities still have additional needs, again, a year down the line, 2 years down the line, once this money is spent? So I think to a lot of extent, everyone wants the money, and it's going to very much be a wait and see approach.
I will say, too, one of the first specific asks I've seen for ARPA Bill 2.0 came from a group of housing advocates who are asking for a second bill this session. So by, you know, next July, spending another $600 million on housing and homeownership. So that would be doubling it. And I, you know, other than that, I think, like Shira said, everyone's going to want more, and everything that didn't make it into the first bill will be brought up again for whatever future version might take shape.
And speaking of the one in front of us right now, all eyes on the governor, what's the timing look like?
Monday is his deadline. So we should, know soon.
All right. And then you all get to pivot directly into budget season. On a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you?
I'm not ready to pivot into consensus revenue yet. No way.
Just absolutely not. Well, I think that's all we have time for right now. But again, thank you so much to Katie Lannon and Shira Schoenberg for coming through and walking us through this bill.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And that brings us to our final segment. This week, we're bringing you another edition of Something to Watch. And in fact, Lisa, right now, what you're watching is happening in real time, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been keeping one eye on the television while we've been recording this episode of The Horse Race to see what happens with the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts nomination of Suffolk District Attorney Rachel Rollins.
And this has turned into a perhaps predictably really partisan fight out there on the Hill. It's been rehashing Rollins' career as Suffolk County DA, which of course course, has been pretty divisive depending on who you ask. And this kind of nomination process right now has involved tie-breaking. It's involved lots of stump speeches about the role of a prosecutor in the modern era. So, Lisa, we've just been vamping for a bit. We've been stalling for time. There is now a result. How did everyone vote? What's the verdict?
The action was unfolding all day, but the votes are in, and Vice President Kamala Harris cast the tie-breaking vote to confirm Suffolk DA Rachel Rollins as the next U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. And it also makes her the first Black woman to hold the post in this state. So now the scramble begins. Governor Charlie Baker will have to appoint someone to fill out the rest of Rollins' term in the Suffolk DA's office, which stretches until next year. Assistant District Attorney Dan Mulhern has actually taken himself out of contention, even though Rachel Rollins had advocated strongly for him at first. But those who are still in the mix, or have been in the mix over time, include Linda Champion, who ran against Rollins in the 2018 Suffolk DA's race, Kevin Hayden, who currently heads the state's Sex Offender Registry Board, and Boston City Councilor Michael Flaherty. And this vote to confirm Rachel Rollins also essentially kicks off the 2022 DA's race.
But that is all the time we have right now. I am Jennifer Smith, here with Lisa Kaczynski. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts, subscribe to Massachusetts Politico Playbook, and ping the Mass Inc. polling group for polls. We will see you soon.